Greetings, folks. Welcome back to another Truth Factor discussion. We're about to jump right into our study through Paul's letter to the churches of Galatia. We're in Galatians chapter 6 today. We'll start there in verse 1. We'd like to thank you so much for joining us for our study today. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can drop them into the Facebook comment area on this video or the YouTube chat area if you're watching us over there. Or you can send us an email, send it to questions at truthfactorlive.com. That's questions at truthfactorlive.com. And we definitely would love to hear from you this morning. We're missing Paul and Brendan today. They both had other responsibilities that came up. And so they are away doing that. But with the four of us here, we can start driving the car and see how far we get in this particular letter here. Now, before we read, you know, we have this divided up for us in chapters and verses, and that's not the way that the Apostle Paul wrote. There were some things that he dealt with in chapter 5 that we've already talked about, the works of the flesh. He warns about verse 26, let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. And then he steps right into instructing brethren on what to do if someone is overtaken in a fault. So if you have someone that maybe is walking in the way of the Judaizing teachers, if you have someone, this is, you know, him talking to them, maybe there was a brother or sister who was trying to push this idea, the things that the Judaizing teachers were teaching, or maybe there's just some other issue. What do you do about that? And the idea here presents a very caring and loving and careful way of helping to instruct one another's in the way of the Lord, to turn us back to the Lord. So let's go ahead and start reading in verse number 1. And Mr. Bob, would you mind reading for us verses 1 through 5 there?
All right. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each of you looking to yourself, so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. For each one must examine his own work, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another. For each one will bear his own load.
Okay. What translation were you reading out of, just for
clarification? It was LSB.
LSB, okay.
It's the okay. Bible. It just happened to be where I was when I last used my Logos.
That is fine. Yep. All right. So when we at the start here of this particular chapter, there, as we said, well, it's dividing up for us there. Oftentimes, when we talk about sin, we talk about the aspect of personal responsibility regarding our actions, and that is accurate. I mean, we are personally responsible. But Bob, who else are we responsible for as far as to be there for them in regards to the subject of sin? Yeah.
Our brethren, especially those who are suffering, those who are undergoing intense persecution or temptation. With persecution comes temptation. Any and all persecution tends toward temptation to forsake God and His Son Jesus Christ, and of course the body of Christ. And this is why I believe the book of Hebrews was written. So many Jews who had become Christians were being persecuted by the unbelieving Jews, that they were going back to the old covenant and supporting the Levitical Aaronic priesthood, rather than giving attention to the service of God under the new covenant.
Yeah, it creates a definite responsibility on our part when a brother, and I hadn't really thought about it from the standpoint of the persecution causing or tempting someone to walk away, to go into an area that is sinful. But it's a simple illustration of if you see someone fall down, you step over and help pick them up. You help them to stand upright. But is there, so when he says, and Brian, I ask you this, if a man is overtaken I think the New King James, in the King James says, if a man is overtaken in a fault, the New King James renders it trespass. How did the LSB render it again there, Bob? If a man is overtaken in any...
If anyone is caught in any transgression.
Okay.
Caught. And one commentator I checked said that means temptation is really after you. It's not talking necessarily about someone who was flirting with danger, but he has been caught by temptation. Temptation has overtaken him. I think that's what one of the translations said. Was that what NKSG said? Overtaken.
And New King James is overtaken. I hadn't really thought about it from that standpoint. And looking at the way the LSB talks about being caught, when you first said that, what went through my mind was the aha, you've been caught in what you're doing. But that's not it at all. It is the idea of it capturing you or catching up and getting a hold of you, such as overtaken. Brian, is he talking about sinful things here when he uses the term trespass?
Well, it's typically how the word trespass is used. And what we could do is we could take this passage and contrast it with our other obligations to Matthew 18. You know, if your brother sins against you, you go to him. 1 Corinthians 6 or 5, and the brother who was in sin that they had to go to. We do understand that if one of our own is falling, we are obligated. We are, as part of the law of Christ, verse 2 is going to say, we are obligated to do everything we can to restore them. You know, this language about the restoration, I'm just thinking about all the different times the scriptures talk about this. 2 Thessalonians 3, a good chunk of that chapter uses almost the same language to say, hey, if somebody's not walking right, admonish him as a brother, there's a constant sense that, that need is addressed and cared about, because that's part of the obligation of each one of us, that we're supposed to be watching out for each other. And I think that's if we're ready to go to it, verse 2, why verse 2 is such an important verse. I think verse 2 is one of the most important verses here in the book of Galatians. It's one I probably quote even more than Galatians 3:27 or elsewhere. And the reason is, number one, this is the first reference to the expression, the law of Christ, in the book of Galatians. And it's good to see it because it helps us to understand that when Paul has been talking about a law that, that couldn't justify, he's not talking about the law of Christ. Now we have the law of Christ, and he's talking about fulfilling that law and fulfilling that law in the love of one another, very similar to what Romans tells us as well, that there is a law that we're under. In other words, if somebody said, hey, the book of Galatians is telling me we're not under law, well, Galatians 6:2 is talking about the law that we are under, the law of Christ. But more so, one of the chief characteristics of this law, or the at the heart of fulfillment of this law, is the need to bear each other's burdens. I'm also going to jump ahead, John, and just kind of ask the question and throw it out there. The skeptics love to grab verse 2 and verse 5 and say, look, here's a Bible contradiction. And it's kind of an important point that we make a distinction on that. John, I'll throw it back to you. And then I do have a couple other thoughts, but I don't want to derail us yet. So.
Well, derailment's what we do with ease. So I think it's a good point. And I'm glad you touched on verse 2. And I think it'd be a good thing to compare the verses 2 and 5. Just make sure that people understand, which I know our current participants do, of course. But before we do that, Bob, what are your thoughts on this?
I'm made to think of the book of Jude, beginning with verse 22. And on some who are doubting, have mercy. And for others, save, snatching them out of the fire. And on others, have mercy with fear, hating even the tunic polluted by the flesh. And so to me, you've got to take each situation on its own merits. You've got to consider the situation underhand. Is this a high-handed sin that this individual is involved in? Is it, again, caught in any transgression implies that he wasn't really flirting with with temptation. It just caught him. And so there comes a time when you have to withdraw. But it's not the first thing you do, even as a congregation. You've got to work with that individual. You show mercy. You show love, as Brian pointed out, and as Paul pointed out himself in Galatians 6:2, fulfill the law of Christ. We've got to do that, have that uppermost in our mind. What is the best thing for this individual who has been caught in a transgression?
That's a good point. You said something that I really liked and was going to comment on, but it didn't stick very long. What was that?
You want me to repeat everything?
Yeah, would no. the idea, well, I guess I don't remember what the thought was, but, and I think it's a good point. It has a lot to do with the nature of the sin. You know, as far, not the nature of it per se. Is it habitual? Is it something like you were saying, they just gotten caught in? Because sometimes something that is initially, like someone stumbles and they fall, you can deal with that, help them up. But if this is something they've been doing for a long time, it's much harder. You know, I remember what it was. You talked about not withdrawing right away. There it is. Spiritual, when we talk about this subject of sin and everything, there's a spiritual illness that becomes, that is afoot. When you have an individual who's no longer serving the Lord. And so if you were sick, you wouldn't go see the mortician first. You're sick, you go to the doctor and try to get the illness resolved. And I think as Christians, our first responsibility, and this goes back to what you're saying there, Bob, is to help heal, if you would, our brother who is spiritually sick, to get them back to a point of faithfulness to the Lord before we then begin to take the disciplinary steps we see in the scriptures there. You know, a lot of times they're sick and they need to be helped.
But you can't afford to wait until the situation becomes dire.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. When people are struggling with temptation and we have no idea because we don't have the fellowship that we should have, we don't have the communion that we should have in the first place, we have no idea that they're struggling for whatever, and they should let us know, but for whatever reason, they're struggling so much they can't talk about it. And months pass, weeks pass, months pass, years pass. Finally said, you know, we need to withdraw from this individual. We ain't seen him in a year. Well, what were you doing a year ago?
Right. Yeah. What have you done individually to try to, you know, start that process way back?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Brian, you were starting to say a while ago. Sorry. Try to help us out there.
I wasn't sure where you were going. I thought maybe we're going to talk about the concepts of love that were involved in this. Back in Galatians chapter 5, Paul threw out the idea that the law is fulfilled in love. James 2, he says, if you fulfill the royal law, you love your neighbors yourself. And again, the royal law, it's easy to see that that's the law of Christ, because Moses' law is not royal. It's not, Moses wasn't a king. The royal law is the law of Christ. And Paul is no doubt insinuating the law of Christ in Galatians chapter 5. So it's important, again, to catch this significance. I want to throw one more thought at this, if that's okay. And I haven't even let Tom say anything. And Tom, I'm sorry. But one thing that I think is really important is that, you know, every time we come together in our congregation, we offer an invitation. We say, hey, if you've got something you need to let be known and pray about. And one of the things we do is we implore people based on Galatians 6:2, and we say, if you don't give us your burden, if you don't share with us what's going on, we're not going to be able to fulfill the law of Christ. So how are we going to get to heaven? How are we going to, you know, how are we going to find, you know, the right way to do things to fulfill Christ's law if we're not willing to share with each other the things we struggle with? You know, James 5 talks about pray for one another, you know, and, you know, confess your sins to one another. But we have such a tightness of, I don't want anybody to know my weakness, that it's too bad. Because so I know that, as I said, most of the time when we offer the opportunity, we say, please tell us what's going on so we can pray about this, so we can bear that burden, so that we can all do what we need to do. Because, you know, by sharing your burden, you're helping the rest of us get to heaven. That's the point I always like to draw out of Galatians 6:2.
All right, that's a good point. Good point. Any other thought right at this point? There's something else we need to mention about the section in and of itself, and then I'll give out one more thought we'll throw in there. But Tom, you got any thoughts?
Well, I think you all have been covering it well. Just understand that you get to this word burden versus the word load in verse 5. They're two different words. The word burden here is a heavy load. It's in verse 2. It's something that you may not be able to handle on your own, or you cannot handle it on your own. You need help. You know, it's the carrying the piano up the stairs, or something to that effect. And you know, Brian's exactly right about, you know, we need to be willing to do that. And this is a challenging situation when you've got opposing views in a congregation, and there's always a good chance of that. You know, I think of, you know, this letter, you know, Paul's writing this, and there's so much application for us, but think about how Paul ties this into what he's talked about for the rest of this letter. You know, he's talking to these brethren, and he's basically saying, as you work through your differences concerning Judaism, this is the way you need to treat each other. And this bearing one another's burdens is a two-way street. Both sides need to have the proper attitude. You know, I do believe that in many instances, a lot of brethren are fearful to go to others and open up to them because of the way that they perceive that they will be treated. And the sad reality is the history of many congregations and the brotherhood is their right. You know, it. I'm not saying it is right, but in some circumstances, they're right. They confess their trespasses, and rather than helping their brethren, make it worse.
Okay, all right.
Example of that would be in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, where apparently the fornicator had repented,
yeah,
and yet they still had not welcomed him back into their fellowship with open arms, and were in danger of causing him to be swallowed up in sorrow. And right. So they had to be told, okay, you did what I told you to do, and he's done what we had hoped that he would do, and now let's receive him back. And that gets back to the whole purpose of withdrawing. It's yeah. not just for the sake of punishment,
but yeah, exactly.
to bring them back.
Right. Yeah, and like you say, that's the last step. You know, you could give the illustrations of this. Somebody comes forward, and they're broken. They're maybe weeping, you know, as they confess their sins. And then somebody comes up to them, puts their finger in their face. You know, how dare you? I'm so disappointed in you. Or yeah, that's not the time. That's not the time for that. You've got that situation. That's the time to go up there and see if there's anything you can do. You know, I mean, if there's sin that's being dealt with, obviously it's got to be addressed properly. But the bottom line is they need to know that you genuinely care, and they also need to know that they can trust you. I remember hearing one time a lesson dealing with struggles with temptations and struggles with sin when somebody confesses and so on. And the preacher made the observation toward the end of the lesson. He said, "Brethren, we have to stop gossiping." And you know exactly what he meant by that. I believe that keeps a lot of people from coming forward and opening up is they fear that their circumstance is going to be worse afterwards than if they just bear it or if they just keep it to themselves. And the sad reality is there's plenty of instances where they're right. And it shouldn't be. There's a problem in a congregation if that's the case. But that's what makes this so difficult.
And we should remember that anytime we pointing one finger at somebody else, there's three fingers pointing back at us. Yeah. So yeah. Instead of pointing fingers, we need to walk up to them and put our arms around their shoulders.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then there are those who come forward that do so with the agenda. You know, they're not really genuinely repentant, and they come forward with looking for things to be the way they want it. And when things are not, they start making accusations, and they make it worse on the rest of the congregation. And we need to be concerned about that. So, yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Well,
challenging subject.
It is. Keep in mind, though, in the first three verses, the point is on what to do when a brother's overtaken in a fault. It's not so much about the brother and instructions to him. It's about us dealing with them. But then when you bring in verses 4 and 5, and I really think this is where 5 comes in, for each one shall bear his own load. He's talking about the person that goes to the brother to try to help steer him back. All right, that brother, if I'm the one who is spiritual and I'm going to go help someone, I've got a level of responsibility that I must uphold, examining my own works to make sure that what I'm doing is out of the right motives, the proper desires, and bearing my own load so that I can help someone else bear their load as earlier. But what is not talked about here, and I think this is a scripture conversation, but maybe other passages, the responsibility of the one who is being helped, okay? If I'm going to go to you, or you come to me even, you say, John, I've noticed this, we need to talk about, you know, this within your life that's obvious, or I come to you and say, listen, I'm struggling with this, I need some help, and you tell me, okay, John, here's what the scriptures teach, A, B, C, and D. And here's my suggestion on, you know, my experience, but here's what scriptures teach. If I say, well, okay, I've done my part to come to you, but I don't have to do what you tell me. You know, if I ignore what you're telling me, then all I have done is reported my deeds, not really sought to turn away from the deeds. And I think some people do that. I think they come down, I think I've seen cases where they come down. Because we're live, I'm not going to share an information, a situation that happened live. But I've seen cases where people have come down front, sat down front, admitted to something. All they were doing was reporting because nothing ever changed. Nothing ever changed whatsoever. And so if I turn to my brethren for help and my brethren come and offer my help and I completely reject it and ignore it, then I'm just as wrong as I was before, if not even worse, because now I'm willingly walking in something, despite having at least having had some try to help me out of it.
John, I think what's neat about what you're saying is all of us have experienced that, where somebody comes to us for advice, we say, well, here's what the scriptures say, and they say, let me go find another opinion. You know, you think of even in Jeremiah, when Jeremiah's with the leftover remnant, and they say, hey, Jeremiah, ask God what we should do and we'll do it. And he asked God and God says, do this. And they said, no, we don't like that. That's what you're talking about. This attitude that says, you know, I'm really struggling with something. Well, here's what you need to do. I don't want to do that. You know? That's the attitude you got there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, building on that, we're kind of, I don't know if you're already in verses 4 and 5, but you know, you've got that word load, which is different than the word burden. I believe the King James uses the word burden on both of them, or there's a version, and that's a misnomer, because this load in verse 5 is a different word, and it's more descriptive of what you would call a personal load. You know, each one shall bear his own load. You know, and one of the things I thought about with this is, you know, I spent 3 years in the military, which I know is nothing compared to what a lot of people have devoted and so on. But I remember in training and so on that one of the first things that we went through is we were assigned our own backpack. And those backpacks were not necessarily light. You know, I mean, it was, in other words, it could be a challenge to carry it and so on, especially with everything. But everything that was in there had a purpose. But nevertheless, it was your responsibility to carry your own backpack and to carry your own supplies. Not that, and it's not necessarily simple. It's not necessarily easy, but you've got to do your part. And you know, Ephesians 4, you know, talks about how every part does its share in verse 16. It says that causes the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. I mean, we all have to do our share. You know, and I think you bring up some good points, John, about, you know, people coming forward and reporting, reporting this is what I've done. And it's almost like a dare. You know, I dare you to challenge me on that type of a circumstance. So you have your own responsibility. And if you're struggling with somebody, if you genuinely come forward, you need to have the attitude that I really want to change. And I'm asking for help, and I'm willing to accept help.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've said.
Michael on the Facebook side, which I'm not able to bring in right now, he says, we need to teach the overtaken brother the meaning of repentance. You know, and now what you're talking about, and Brian brought this up, someone who comes forward before the congregation to request prayers or like that. But there are times where you may have to approach someone. They don't come and say, hey, I've got this problem. I need your prayers and your help. You may observe that this is the situation, and you go to them. They've been caught in sin, and you go to them. And the point, and y'all have already touched on this a good bit, is to get them to change, you know, with a proper loving spirit to get them to turn away from their sin. All right, let's see. So much more.
That's step one of Matthew 18, by the way. That's step one of Matthew 18. So,
and I like what Thomas said about load and burden. It is two different roots, but it is a part of every man's load to help others in their burdens.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got the personal load that is equal across the board. Everybody has the same responsibilities and obligations, but then you've got some who find difficulty because of some circumstance, difficulty in carrying their load. And so that becomes a burden to them. And so we need to go and help them with their burdens, in this case, bringing them to repentance. Or it may be perhaps you can catch it in time to prevent them from sinning. If you, and again, I think one of the problems with withdrawal, we never really share anything in so many places. They never ever share anything that could be withdrawn. We meet together on Sunday morning, some cases Sunday evening, Wednesday evening. But between Wednesday and Sunday, you know, we have no contact with one another. Between Sunday and Wednesday, no contact with one another. And so there's nothing really there to be withdrawn. We're not going to associate with you anymore between Sunday and Wednesday. Or you haven't been associating with me anyway. And I think that's a problem.
And that's a whole nother discussion, too.
Yeah.
But a valid discussion. Yeah. Absolutely. So let's see. One more thought, and then we'll move on to the next section. Let me double check our time. No. Well, just one. If you're going to ask someone for help, and they give you what you need to do, and you don't do it, and you go back to them again, and the same. If you repeat that enough, at some point, someone may say, "Look, don't come back to me for help. You've done this 10 times, and I've told you 10 times what your responsibilities are, what you need to do, and you've ignored it every single time. Don't come back to me and act as if nothing ever happened before." I guess on one hand you should continue, but at some point, are you being a good steward with your time and basically placating the individual, making them feel better for the moment because they've come and they confess their sins to you, but yet the things you're telling them to do from the scriptures, they don't do. You know, at some point, they're now walking in this behavior, in this sin.
And again, maybe we need to spend more time with them than the than the short 5 minutes on the front pew when they come forward.
That's right. Yeah.
Check on them Monday. Check on them Tuesday.
A good example. We'll ramble just a little bit here. One of our brethren here in the past has worked with men who have had addiction. Okay. And he was describing the situation in that you have to stay after them every day. He would go wake them up 4 o'clock in the morning. They would go work out. They would do this. They would do that. You know, everything they needed to do to just exhaust themselves so they would sleep at night. And you have to do it every single day to work with them. You know, you say, well, check in with me once a week and tell me your progress. That really is not the help that in those situations are needing. So back to what Bob's talking about. Sometimes when we get caught up in sin, that sin becomes like a habit within our lives. It persists. And sometimes the idea of if a brother's overtaken in a fault, us, those who are spiritual, restore such a one, you're right. If we really want to try to restore them, our contact has got to be more than once a week, twice a week, you know. And sometimes we don't do that, even speaking personally, too.
5 minutes on the front pew, it's not always going to restore them.
Oh, no. And you know how easy it is to mess that up as a preacher? When I first started preaching, I'll share this. We were in a small little town, and sweet little lady. I don't know if she had ever done anything mean to anybody. She comes forward one Sunday morning, and I have trouble hearing her because she's soft-spoken. But what I heard her say was she's been guilty of saying things that she shouldn't be saying. Now, what she was talking about, I found out later, was a little bit of gossip. What this young preacher said, Sister so-and-so's come forward this morning asking for the forgiveness of using foul language, words that she shouldn't say. Her nephew, I think it was, he came up to me later. He's an older man. And he said, I'll have you to know. So guess who kind of went forward Sunday night and corrected something?
Yeah.
You know, so after that, I started, if someone comes forward, I'm going to tell them what I'm going to say. So they'll tell me what they want to say, and they'll say, okay, here's what I'm going to tell the congregation. Is that okay? Because it's so easy to mess it up
Is this what you are saying to me, or have I misunderstood you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But interestingly enough, there aren't too many biblical examples in the New Testament of people walking forward at the end of Paul's sermons. We do have someone falling forward. More fell out of a window, but okay. Well, we're way off.
He was restored. He was restored.
Yeah,
okay. That's right.
John, can I make one more comment? I know you'd like to move on, but I want to point out.
This is fine.
Michael Davis brought up a comment. He said, "Don't want to beat a dead horse, but just how spiritual are those that are endeavoring to restore the overtaken brethren?" I want to take what Michael said and actually kind of go a different direction. One thing that may occur to people is, why isn't Galatians 6:1 saying, you who are elders, restore such a one? And there's a couple of things you might consider here. One might be that, you know, broadly speaking, maybe a lot of the churches of Galatia don't have elders. And there's an important idea here about who is responsible for things in the absence of elders that you might draw from this. This seems to be the same thing that's being drawn out of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, that whenever in the absence of elders there are spiritual people among you, wise men, as he calls them in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and they are the ones who have an obligation towards activity. They're the ones that are supposed to be taking on, you know, work and such. And it's an important point. I get asked the question a lot, what does a church do if they don't have elders? Well, they should have spiritual men, wise men who make decisions. And so whether it's 1 Corinthians 6 or here in Galatians 1, I point to these passages and I say, this is what a congregation does in the absence of overseers. But the second thing I want to say is, a lot of times we want to say, well, that's the elder's job. You know, some guy's sinning. That's the elder's job. No, it's our job. If we are spiritually discerning enough to see that they are struggling or falling or drifting away, we are then obligated. That's what he's trying to get to us. We can't pass it on and say, well, you know, let's throw it out to the elders. Tom throws in our private chat. That's the preacher's job, you know? It's not. It's all of our obligation. And again, this goes to that fulfill the law of Christ conversation. You know, if I'm spiritual, you know, and I, you know, the irony is a lot of people say they're spiritual and then they don't do anything about somebody who's struggling with sin. They don't help or in any way. Well, that's probably a good indication they're not spiritual. They're immature. But the point is, it's all of our obligation to step on this.
And sad thing is, where there are no elders, people look to the preacher as if he's the pastor.
Yeah, that's true. All right. And Caleb kind of made a comment in the chat room that that has been the biggest struggle for him, not something we're taught. And that's true. When I first started preaching, I actually trained with the fellow for a period of time. That wasn't something we conversed about. What do you do when, at least not that I ever remember, you know, when someone comes forward, here's what you need to do, you know. And I do think if there are elders present, and if the, especially if the preacher is not serving as an elder, I'd highly recommend the preacher let the elders talk to the one that's come forward, you know, instead of the preacher himself. I'm not saying he can't, but if there are elders present and he's not serving as one, let the elders step forward.
You know? Let the elders eld.
That's right. That's right. All right. Let me see. We have a few minutes remaining here, so let's go ahead and look at the next section there. Let's see. All right, Brian, if you could go ahead and read verses 6 through 10, and then I've got a question that I'm going to ask you very specifically about this.
All right. All right, Galatians 6 through 10, and I'll be reading from the New King James Version. Galatians chapter 6, verses 6 through 10. Let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will reap of the flesh corruption. He who sows to the Spirit will reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith.
Okay. So the question is this spiritual or physical? Now, the reason why I ask the question, it has to do more with the way we look at verse 10.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, okay. Let's say this. The context of the conversation here actually begins at verse 4. When he begins talking about what each one of us is personally obligated to do, we each have something we're supposed to do. So that's kind of the list he's going to go through. At verse 4, each one of us has our own work, and verse 5, our own load. What is that? Well, one thing is, you know, we share the good things with those who teach us. You know, we're personally, don't talk about this a lot, but we're personally have an expectation that we share. By the way, somebody asked me about that recently and said, does that mean, you know, that was somebody I had studied with. He says, Brian, does that mean I need to be paying you? I said, well, I don't think that's what he means, but I won't say no. You know, no, I said, no, I don't think that's necessarily what he means, but it is good that you let me know when you're doing good things, because it's a great encouragement to me. You know, I'm utterly lifted up. I think of John saying there's no greater blessing than hearing your children are walking faithfully. He's kind of talking about something like this. So that's a neat thing. You know, but then he goes on to say, hey, don't be deceived. You know, you're going to get what you're going to reap what you sow. And if you're all about the flesh, that's what you're going to get. Don't grow weary. Verse 10, every opportunity, whether it's the believer or unbeliever, do good. But this is all within the context of my own load. The things God personally looks at me and says, Brian, this is what you are responsible for. This is what you need to be working on. So that's an important point.
All right. I appreciate that. Yeah.
I really think, if I may butt in here, all good things, I believe it was all good things. In Acts chapter 2, we see the apostles sharing in their knowledge of God's word with the people. And then from Acts chapter 2 through Acts chapter 8, we have the people sharing in all good things with one another, because you've got Jews and Jewish proselytes who have come from all over the Roman Empire to worship, to celebrate Pentecost. They hear the gospel, they become Christians, They have probably limited funds. They have come to stay a certain period of time, just long enough to celebrate Pentecost. But now they've become Christians. They've got to learn their responsibilities, their obligations. They've got to learn about Jesus. They've got to learn about all kinds of things that the apostles are sharing with them. But they're running out of money, these people. And so the people, the Christians who live in and around Jerusalem, they're selling their property and sharing good things with the brethren that are come from all over the Roman Empire. And so I really believe that in chapter 6, he's not really starting a new subject, or verse 6. There is kind of a gradual segue into the physical, but let him who is taught in the word share in all good things. And I think that ties together the spiritual aspect of the first five verses and the physical aspect of the next five verses. And so we ought to share with one another, and not necessarily talking about paying the preacher, but it does necessarily, to me, imply you help out anyone who needs your help, if you can help them. And, don't put it all off on the church, but if you can help them, help them. If you can't, find someone who can, and share what we have, share in all good things what we have. And that word, I think, is fellowship, is it not, Koinonia?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what fellowship is all about, sharing in all good things.
Okay. All right. Any thoughts?
Bob bring a good observation about that. I've heard some emphasize, and I think the primary emphasis is spiritual. Because you're dealing with this brother that's overtaken in a fault, and your responsibility toward that. But that's a great point that Bob brings out. Why can't it be both? Especially when he makes the point there in verse number 10, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. He makes a distinction between the household of faith and those who are not. What good are you going to do for those who are not of the household of faith to help them overcome their trespasses? Your good to them is going to be example. It's going to be helping them in whatever way you can, maybe helping them to deal with some things in their life and so on, but it's broader. So why can't it be both?
Okay. All right.
Or as I like to say in sermons, see all of the above.
So. All right. The reason why I asked the question, or just kind of threw it out there, is a brother I knew one time, or actually still knows, kind of held the position that since verse 6 begins with someone teaching the word of God, that the good seen in verse 10, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good, especially to those who are the household of faith. He kind of makes connection between the two of those, that the good is the teaching, the good is the spiritual edification. And I don't remember him bringing verse 8 into it, but verse 8 says, for he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will the Spirit reap everlasting life. Now, I do think that's more centered in the context of even going back to the works of the flesh versus the fruit of the Spirit. What is your ultimate goal? Especially in serving the Lord, helping others as a role in that service there. But anyway, that's why I asked the question. Thought it was interesting. Go ahead, Bob.
There is a distinction in verse 6 between an implied distinction between him who teaches and him who is taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only are we who are spiritually minded responsible to those who are overtaken in a fault, but we who are taught are to share in all good things with him who teaches. Him who teaches, I don't think, is the one who is overtaken in a fault.
Right.
That's the one who is sharing with you spiritual matters, And then you have a responsibility, a reciprocal responsibility to sharing him with physical things. I mean, this was the whole purpose of Paul's third missionary journey. And he says as much in 2 Corinthians and also in Romans, that it is their responsibility, having benefited spiritually from the saints in Jerusalem indirectly, to now benefit them physically or materially, now that they have it rough. We've been taught by them, or you have been taught by them, you need to be sharing with them in this tragedy that they are experiencing.
That's a good comparison. That's a good point. All right, any other thoughts? Any other thoughts on this? Now, the one area we did go in our discussion, and since we are this close to the end of the time, now's when you bring subjects like this up. I have had this passage used before. I've heard it used before, I should say, in regards to the work of the local church and the benevolent aspect to everyone. And one thing to point out is if you ask the question, what's the difference between the Galatian letter and the Colossae letter, or Galatian letter and the Ephesian letter, or even the Galatian letter and the Roman letter? What's the difference? And the difference is all the other letters that Paul wrote, with the exception of Philemon, was to a local congregation. And if you look at those letters, you see elements of the work being talked about. Even Timothy, although we call it 1 Timothy, could have been said Paul's second letter to the church in Ephesus, in that he deals a lot with the work there, but more as instructionally for Timothy, who would be the one teaching them. But in this case in point, I really believe when it says the churches of Galatia, he's talking about the called out. And the things he had talks about here was more individual admonition-based, correction-based, than the actual working of the local church. He doesn't even really tell what to do. You know, if in Romans 16, he talks about what to do with someone who causes divisions and offenses contrary to doctrine of Christ. 1 Corinthians 5, what to do if someone who is named a brother engages in these sins. In this case of point, he lays it upon the individual to go correct the other one who is overtaken in a fault. So that's why I kind of think we have to remember who the recipients of this particular letter was, and he doesn't appear to be dealing with local church work as he did in the other epistles. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm sure you probably covered a good bit of this in the early studies that I missed out on, but chapter 1 and verse 6, I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. He's not addressing a congregation or even a group of congregations. Yeah. He's dealing with the individuals in those congregations. It was the individual who were called in the grace of Christ. It's the individuals who are turning away to a different gospel. And I think we see that throughout the epistle. He's dealing with individual matters that had these individual matters, of course, have an impact on each of the local churches of Galatia. But he's dealing with the individual matter, particularly of binding physical circumcision on Gentile Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and building on that, I mean, even if the point is that the letter was addressed to congregations or the Christians in congregations, look at the context of chapter 6, verses 1 through 10. I mean, it's individual. You know, everything that is said in there is addressing individuals. You know, if a man is overtaken in trespass, you who are spiritual, you know, restore them. Bear one another's burdens. You bear each other's burdens. If anyone thinks he is something, you know, himself to be something when he is nothing, let each one examine his own works, bear his own load. Let him who has taught share. You just go on down the list. Oh, whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. All of that, that's individual challenges. So even if you describe or point out that it's written to churches and you could tie some of it to congregations and so on, this context is clearly individuals. And individuals have a whole lot more freedom or leeway in what they can do than a congregation. And Paul bore that out in 1 Timothy 6, or not 1 Timothy, yeah, 1 Timothy 5. In 1 Timothy 5:16, you know, he bore that out. Do not let the church be burdened, you know, dealing with helping the needy.
Okay. All right. Brian, any thoughts on it?
You know, it's kind of interesting. This is a passage that's brought up this in James 1:27, or brought up sometimes by those who support benevolence to all, you know, from the church. I think all the points have been made about this. The context seems to be towards the individual. But even if it wasn't towards the individual, there's really not anything in this statement that says then, well, we have an authority to reach out, particularly when we have no other examples or statements like that in the scripture. And it's really pretty, it would be a really spurious point, you know, because do good to all is such a generic statement that it can really have a pretty broad, you know, implication. I mean, doing good to all could be preaching the gospel to all. It's not, it doesn't really have a specificity to say, you know, hey, do good to all by giving every single person, you know, X amount of money, you know, whatever it might be. There's no specificity to what do good means. It's about as generic as you can get. So for anybody to try to say, well, here's our passage that authorizes the church to be benevolent to everybody, something that, as I said, we specifically intentionally see absent in the book of Acts, that we have no other admonition for, and that the church isn't equipped to do. You know, we can talk about the idea of how a free will offering on the first day of the week is never enough money to cover the needs of everybody in the community. I mean, we pay taxes, which is a mandatory large amount of money, and that can't take care of everybody. So, you know, it's you know, the church is woefully unequipped. Suddenly, the words that say that we're equipped for every good work don't make sense if we're not really, you know, if we're not financially equipped to do this job. So, like I said, even if somebody would make the case, well, I don't know if we're talking about the individual, and I think we are. I think contextually it's set up pretty well. The point is, you could not construe from this that the church is then obligated to be aiding all people who have a need.
Yeah, you know, and just real quick thought on that, and this goes back to the can of worms that John opened by asking Brian the question in the first place, spiritual or physical. You know, the, contextually looking at the things that are being dealt with, while there may be physical things we do for somebody and so on, I mean, a lot of good that we do, the best good we can do is spiritual. You know, I mean, it is spiritual things. It doesn't necessarily have to be the clothes closet or that type of a benevolence and so on. We can do good spiritually. That's what we that's actually the idea of you know, teaching somebody to fish as opposed to giving them a fish. You know, teach them how to do it for themselves, and so that's contextually. Paul's dealing with spiritual things, but there's physical applications as well. So,
yeah, this person you brought up, John, I think you could back him into the corner of having to say that we sow to the flesh or to the spirit only by what we do materially. And of course, that's not the truth, because we have material responsibilities, physical responsibilities, and we have spiritual responsibilities. He who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. He who sows to the flesh. Let us not grow weary. We shall reap if we do not faint. Individuals reap. Churches do not reap. And so, yeah, it all points to the individual. And there are both spiritual and material responsibilities involved here. I don't think you limit it to either one.
That's a good point. Real quick, an illustration that kind of just came to mind that I think helps illustrate this. Oftentimes when a mother, let's say she's got two children and she has her third, baby's just born. The first couple months after that is very hard on that mother, okay, because She has to take care of the new baby. She's got to watch the two little kids. She feels responsible to keeping the house clean and all that other stuff. Sometimes all you've got to do is another lady go over there and listen to her and help her with the house. So your company with them is that mental encouragement. Give them someone to talk to. Give them someone to cry to. Let them know, just be there to listen. But then you go and help with the physical things. And while they're not as important as the mental encouragement you're giving, they will help to make the person feel better about the situation. And maybe sometimes while our great responsibility is spiritual edification, the physical help will be a benefit as well if we're able to. Go ahead, Bob.
That gives them the mental relaxation that they need. I mean,
yeah,
we all need to relax mentally from the daily duties of life. Well, not preachers, obviously, but that's a joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, help them out. You don't sit there while dishes need to be washed and talk to the woman.
Yeah, yeah.
If dishes need to be washed, wash the dishes.
Yeah,
do what you can for her. Matter of fact, that's the implication of the word visit. I think in James chapter 2 and verse 20, James 1:27, mm-hmm. Visit. It's more than just sitting down and talking with them.
That's a good point. Very good point.
I think it's the same word for, isn't it Episcopus there, the word from which bishop comes, or from that root?
The idea of the, yeah, I think so. Bob said a very important word, relax. And so speaking of relaxing, it's time for us to relax for a week. You know, preachers, we only work on one day a week, maybe two sometimes. So let's go ahead. We'll pull our study to a close. Let's plan next Thursday to pick up with Galatians chapter 6, verse 11. Now, here's the thing. There's not 40 verses in this chapter. There's just a few more left. But there are some things that Paul talks about I think would be good for us to discuss. And it'll also give us an opportunity to kind of wrap the whole letter up. See if there's some certain threads we want to talk about, some concluding remarks. And we'll bring into discussion, and Lord willing, we'll finish up the study next Thursday. I really appreciate everyone joining us today. Really appreciate your attention. And for those who are able to comment, I really appreciate that. If you're watching this at a later time and you've got more thoughts about what we've been talking about, then be sure to share them with us. You can send them to questions@truthfactorlive.com. We would love to hear from you. questions@truthfactorlive.com. All right, gentlemen, anything else?
What's next on the agenda after Galatians?
After Galatians, we are looking at potentially studying about what people call the end times.
Okay.
How should we worry about what's going on in Israel from a biblical standpoint? We're talking about kind of getting into that type of study for a couple of weeks or so,
Okay.
Some brethren are troubled by it.
All right.
Yeah, so, all right, everybody, we'll see you again next Wednesday, next Thursday, 11 o'clock a.m. Y'all have a great week.
Bye-bye. Bye.